Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
I mean, obviously, because we're taking such a narrow focus on this as it applies to ag labor, and we have deliberately steered clear of the immigration part of it, because anytime you put comprehensive in front of an effort, it usually dooms the effort.
Arkansas Representative Rick Crawford on ag worker reform.
So we've deliberately taken a very targeted approach to how we address this problem. And we think, based on the feedback that we're getting, that it's actually making a difference. We're hearing that from our colleagues on both sides of the aisle. This has been a very good bipartisan effort, and we think we can get some bicameral uptake as well. So I think the approach has been appropriate. I think we're going to see a really good opportunity for the first time to actually affect some positive change.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
As of November the 5th, 81% of the crop was harvested. You can see a little bit ahead of average there.
Chief of the Crops Branch at USDA's National Ag Statistics Service, Lance Honig. The latest crop production numbers.
Last year we were a little bit faster than this, but certainly moving right along, as I mentioned. So with that in mind, of course, no change to the planted or harvested acreage as you would normally see in November. But as a reminder, acreage, of course, up fairly sharply this season. Yield, though, we're now forecasting 174.9 bushels per acre. That is up 1.1% or 1.9 bushels per acre from last month's forecast. So we're now up 0.9% year over year on that yield. That puts our new production forecast at 15.2 billion bushels, 1.1% above last month and 11.1% more than last season. And yes, that is a record high production for corn this season. Next, we'll take a quick look at the U.S. corn yield and how it compares over the last 30 seasons. You can see the trend line plotted in there as well. That 174.9 bushel forecast does represent the fourth highest yield on record, but still falls below trend.
Honig also on Thursday taking a deeper dive into soybeans, starting with harvest.
91% of the soybeans were harvested, so nearly complete. They're a little bit ahead of average again. That was 86%, and just a couple of ticks behind last season. Like corn, no change in the planted and harvested area compared with last month. But unlike corn, acreage, of course, for soybeans down this season, but our yield now 49.9 bushels per acre. That's up just 0.6% or 0.3 bushel from last month's forecast. So overall, we are now up 0.6% or 0.3 bushel from last year. That puts production of 4.13 billion bushels. Again, up 0.6% month over month, but still down 3.3% year over year due to the reduced acreage this season. Here for soybeans, again, you can see how the yields compare over the last 30 seasons, fifth highest yield on record for soybeans, but like corn, still falling below trend this year.
Honig also taking a deeper dive into cotton and a few surprises.
Harvest progress there, 57% complete as of November the 5th, 55% is the average, 61% last year, so pretty much right in line with what we would normally see. Again, no change to the acreage for cotton this month. Obviously, planted area down significantly, but rebounding from the big abandonment issues last year. So overall, actually an increase in harvested area this year. Fairly small change to yield this month. You can see actually up 2.1% or 16 pounds per acre from last month. Still down sharply from last year, but with a high abandonment last year, very high yield. But you'll see the sharp drop in the next chart coming up. Overall, it puts us at 13.1 million bales, up from last month and 9.5% below what was produced last year. As promised, here you can see that sharp drop in yield, but again, falling off partly from a very high yield last year, but also some struggles this year as well. In fact, that does represent the lowest all cotton yield since 2015.
He had no changes for sorghum area planted or harvested, but
yield down 10.5% month over month as we get through harvest. For that crop, just not quite as good as folks were expecting, but still much better than the low yields that we saw due to the drought last year.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
And the reality is that there are a multitude of reasons why it's necessary for us to expand broadband access in rural and remote areas.
How long has Congress and the government been talking about rural broadband? Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
Farmers need this technology to fully embrace precision agriculture, to lower input costs and to increase productivity and profit on their farms. They also need it to be able to make sure they have access to real-time market information as they make key decisions for their operations. Certainly communities, rural communities, see this as a necessity, whether it's expanding opportunities with telemedicine or providing distance learning for students, especially in the face of ongoing pandemic. There are significant needs for communities in quality of life connected to broadband access. Small business needs it to expand economic opportunity and markets, and families need it to bind and bond together during times of separation. We certainly have experienced that in the last year and a half to 2 years in this country.
Following Senate passage of the infrastructure bill 2 years ago, Vilsack outlining what the plan was.
Let me give you a couple of examples of how these resources will be of help and assistance, and then I'm going to turn it over to Jim. In rural Georgia, we're making a combination grant and loan that's going to provide additional access to high-speed internet for over 6,600 households, 10 healthcare facilities, 574 businesses, and 107 farms. In rural Arizona, a grant of a significant amount of nearly $14 million is going to expand fiber to over 5,500 households, including a school and a healthcare facility in the community. In rural Virginia, we're going to see 37 educational facilities, 14 community facilities, 193 businesses benefit from a significant grant for expanded broadband access. These are real-life consequences of investments that are very much needed in rural places, and we're excited about the role that USDA has played under the ReConnect program and will continue to play to upgrade and ultimately to expand access to this important and vital technology for competitiveness and economic opportunity in the future.
Shirley Bloomfield is with the Rural Broadband Association.
I represent community-based providers across about 35% of the landmass of the United States. While I have all of the cooperatives, I have hundreds of community-based providers who are just locally owned and locally controlled. And these are folks who live and work and play in the communities where they provide broadband service. One of the things that I think we've learned a lot over the course of the last year and a half, most unfortunately, is that broadband is not nice to have. It is a must-have. And I think that the pandemic has highlighted the critical nature of the need to have access to fast and affordable and comparable broadband services, regardless of where you live in this country. We have a little bit of a divide. People like to talk about the digital divide. I will actually share, I think it's more of a rural-rural divide. You have the rural America that is served by community-based providers and other intriguing partnerships and players that have come in. And you have the rural America that is served by some of the larger providers that have really been lagging behind. That is why I think the ReConnect program that USDA has put into effect and implemented over the course of the last 2 years has been really powerful.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Plains Cotton Growers covers a 42-county service area, and so we go from the western side, which is the Texas-New Mexico line, all the way up to the top of Texas, to the Oklahoma border with the Oklahoma Panhandle, and then back around to the edge of the Caprock, and we follow the Caprock down to all the way as far south as Big Spring, which, and you know, you and I are visiting by telephone currently, and I happen to be down on the southern end today, down at Big Spring, America.
Mark Brown is Director of Field Services with Lubbock-based Plains Cotton Growers.
And then we go all the way back toward Midland. So look at that total area that encompasses 42 counties of the Texas High Plains.
It's the largest cotton-growing region in the U.S., and Brown says prices for fiber have been down. What about seed?
I can tell you that we were very concerned also because of all of the small bolls that are out there, and some of the very first reports that I heard about coming in from the gin was a seed weight of less than 600 pounds on some of those bales that per bale that were coming out from the gins. But since that time, I've been hearing much more favorable numbers in terms of seed weight per bale, and I'm glad of that. As I travel around, of course, there's always going to be a range of prices that are being offered by the gins to the farmer, but I'm seeing most of the offerings to farmers from the gin going somewhere in the range of around $250 to $270 per ton. And so that's very good. That's not anywhere near where we were at last year, whenever we had such high seed prices that helped make up for some of the losses in the production. But at the same time, whenever we look long-term at seed values, that's not a bad price.
Like the rest of those in ag, cotton concerned about the expiration of the farm bill.
The bill that we're currently operating under officially expired at the end of September, and so there's a lot of work going on about getting the next farm bill done. We've had a lot of holdups. We had to change speakers in the House of Representatives, and that took approximately 3 weeks. And then in addition to that, Congress is working on a looming deadline of November 17th, whenever they're going to run out of funding for the government again, and they're going to have to pass some type of funding resolution in order to prevent another government shutdown. And so that has somewhat curtailed all of the discussions and all the work that's gone on with the farm bill, given us somewhat of a delay. The House, we've got our House Ag Committee Chairman, G.T. Thompson, and he is working closely with our new Speaker, Mike Johnson, and they are still hoping to get something passed through the House by the end of December. But actually, we know that it's really going to require an extension of the current farm bill, because even though we could possibly get it passed in the House, then we have to reconcile that with the Senate version and have a final passage of the farm bill. So it will be going into certainly 2024. And so currently what we're looking at is an extension, likely a one-year extension from what I'm hearing.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I am. We are at the NOG U.S. Wheat Fall Board Meeting here in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Chandler Gould is CEO of the National Association of Wheat Growers, commonly referred to as NOG.
Kicked off our meeting yesterday with a tour of the Seymour flour mill, which was, of course, very interesting to see where our product goes once it leaves our farms. And today we're sitting down and going to start discussing policy.
Now, when it comes to policy, the two organizations completely separate, but they do work together.
Most definitely. You know, NOG is very much on domestic policy, making sure that our farmers have got everything they need for risk management. As we know, there's so many variables in farming. And then, of course, the U.S. Wheat Associate is the trade arm of the wheat industry. And so we meet together twice a year to not only discuss trade and you know, like other issues facing the entire industry, but then, of course, we each go back to our respective corners, and we go to the Capitol Hill, and the U.S. Wheat goes to foreign countries to help continue to build out those foreign markets, and we make sure that they've got enough wheat to do so.
What makes wheat somewhat interesting is the fact that there's not really a start or end to the season.
I mean, it's a little bit like dairy and a little bit like postal. You're exactly right. We've got winter and spring wheat, and we've got wheat in the ground year-round somewhere in the United States, unlike most other commodities.
The expiration of the 2018 Farm Bill, not yet dire for most commodities, but for wheat growers and those in the dairy industry, January 1st could be big.
You know, I think overall, you know, coming out of the several years of drought, there's definitely been some concern about just moving forward and making sure that we've got the appropriate risk management tools in place. Of course, we continue to work on the Farm Bill reauthorization. As you know, it expired on September 30th of this year. And really looking at how do we increase the Farm Bill so that the safety net is actually keeping up with cost of production. And when you look at when the bill was last reauthorized, from 2018 to 2023, cost of production has skyrocketed for multiple reasons. And we need to make sure that we have the best risk management tools and leverages in that bill so that our producers, you know, have some certainty going forward. And we continue to work with both the House and Senate Agriculture Committees to get that bill fully reauthorized and updated for another 4 to 5 year term.
Doesn't look like there's any way a new farm bill coming now for this year, but where are we going? Gould explains.
Well, you know, it kind of changes a little bit every day. Once we finally got a Speaker of the House, which that was a major delay, not just on the farm bill, but on all legislation. I mean, the main thing facing Congress right now is funding the government. The stopgap funding runs out on November 17th. And so if the House and the Senate can't come to some sort of resolution on how to fund the government, then we're going to see a shutdown, which is going to significantly delay any legislation, but especially for us in the farming community and the wheat growers, the farm bill. And so until the Congress can figure out how to fund itself for a longer term, I'm a little worried that the farm bill is going to continue to be pushed. We already know it's going to be pushed into next year. The question is, how far? We're talking March, May, and then you get into the election cycle. So there's just a lot of variables floating around. But if we can't, first we've got to fund the government so we can truly focus on passing the farm bill.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
My name is Jeannie Merrill. I'm the Policy Director for the California Climate and Agriculture Network, a coalition of the state's leading sustainable and organic agriculture organizations.
She explains why carbon markets have failed to deliver on their promise.
Since 2009, we've worked to advance agricultural solutions to the climate crisis at the state and federal levels, working in partnership with the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition. Thank you for the opportunity to address the important issue of carbon markets and their potential in supporting farmers in mitigating and adapting to climate change. Today, I'll speak to the California experience of the carbon markets and our state Climate Smart Agriculture programs. I'll begin my remarks with an overview of the original market efforts in this space. Agriculture can and must be a part of the country's efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, increase carbon sinks, and improve resilience. Effective policy tools exist to help farmers achieve these goals. However, since 2003, carbon markets have proved themselves an inadequate tool to reach the diversity of farmers and ranchers we must reach. Simply put, carbon market approaches at the voluntary and compliance levels have consistently failed to deliver on climate solutions in agriculture on any meaningful scale, leaving the vast majority of farmers without adequate resources to address the climate crisis. The Chicago Climate Exchange was the first national effort to put a carbon market in place in 2003. The exchange set up a market for offset credits generated by farmers whose practices reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Practices such as rotational grazing, conservation tillage, prairie plantings. Companies and local governments would buy those credits as a way of voluntarily offsetting their own emissions. Farmer response to the exchange was considerable. Within 2 years, the Farmers Union had 2.6 million agricultural acres under contract with the exchange in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Montana, and the Dakotas. The Iowa Farm Bureau had another 600,000 acres under contract. By 2010, the exchange had collapsed. The carbon market was swamped with offset credits from willing farmers, but didn't have enough buyers. And as a result, the price of carbon credits went from a high of roughly $7 to just 5 cents per metric ton of CO2 equivalent. In December 2010, the exchange closed its doors, leaving farmers without support for their projects. The next significant effort to create a carbon market came from California. In 2012, as part of its climate change law, the state launched a cap and trade program requiring large greenhouse gas emitters to participate. Now, 5 years later, 9 years later, there are still very few ways for farmers to earn carbon credits. And they include installing dairy digesters and taking up certain rice management practices, both aimed at reducing methane emissions. But with a low carbon price and high transaction cost for farmers, only the dairy digester projects have sold carbon credits, largely because of other state financial support for those projects. Despite the 7 years it took to develop the rice protocol for the carbon market, the state's rice producers have stayed out of the California carbon market. It just doesn't make financial sense. Instead of relying on the carbon market, starting in 2014, the state of California launched its first grants-based climate change programs for farmers and ranchers. The Climate Smart Agriculture programs bypass the complexities of the carbon market, offering farmers technical and financial assistance to develop their projects. The programs are modeled after USDA's Farm Bill conservation programs. Farmer response to the state Climate Smart Agriculture programs has been considerable, with application requests far exceeding available funding.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So the Illinois Soy Association has done a lot of work with the Chicago Parks District, okay, as far as running their big diesel mowers and the people that don't have cabs on those, as far as the exhaust and how those people feel at the end of the day versus regular diesel, and how much cleaner and better for the environment, and also the workers that they do by running 20% biodiesel.
Rob Schaefer is an Illinois soybean producer on how end users see clean fuels.
We've also got studies where in impacted areas or low-income areas, it's where they run diesel buses and that kind of, the biodiesel buses and that kind of stuff, where it's a lot less accident or evidences of asthma and that kind of stuff. So we've got a lot of work with the farmers' money as far as doing research, just how much cleaner the fuel is and how much better it is to breathe. And a cool thing we used to say when we were little, especially when we were just getting into soybeans, I started in 2010 on the Illinois Soybean Board. If you sat next to like a biodiesel bus, it smelled like French fries because they were reclaiming used cooking oil to make that biodiesel. And we always knew when we were next to a, like downtown Peoria, Illinois, especially, they were all on 20% biodiesel and all their bus fleet and that kind of stuff for public transportation. And it's just interesting to see from a bean field or a cornfield or a cattle lot, Peoria is not that big, okay, but it's not Chicago, but it's interesting when farmers get around and they say, you smell that, and it smells like French fries.
But what's important for the clean fuel industry?
So several billions of dollars being built on crush plants, okay, and then our job with those investments from the industry is for, number one, for us to produce the beans so then they can crush them to make it into the sustainable aviation fuel, renewable diesel, and biodiesel. And then also for us as ASA, National Corn Growers, to go to Washington, talk to the champions, Stabenow, Durbin, Duckworth from Illinois, Grassley from Iowa, who wrote the RFS, to communicate not only our message that we communicate with EPA and Administrator Reagan, but also to put pressure from the senators and the House to get with EPA to get that decimal point moved, okay, and explain to them what happens back home with the local jobs, the local farmers, less production. I'm on a co-op board, okay, elevator co-op board, which is a bunch of farmers that own big elevators, okay, and that would mean less volume for us on the bean side, okay. So, it's an unbelievable story that started over 30 years ago when they couldn't get rid of soybean oil, that farmers innovatively took a byproduct, okay, and learned how to make diesel fuel out of it, make energy out of it. That's sustainable. We can grow it every year. It's a drop-in. All you need to do is change filters. I mean, you don't have to change tanks. You don't have to modify things. It's an actual unbelievable win-win-win for the America, the American farmer, and the industry and taxes in general.
Greg Anderson is a soybean grower from Nebraska.
Well, certainly made the soybean business a good business to be in with the demand for biofuels, biodiesel, renewable diesel, and now sustainable aviation fuel. I'll take Nebraska, for example. We have two new crushing plants that are just underway, and that's one is very close by in my county, about 40 miles away. The other is the northeast part of the state. The other one is in the east central part of the state. Those two plants alone will crush 25% of our state's soybean production every year. And so what we're going to be seeing is increased demand. We're going to be seeing better basis levels. We're going to be seeing more competition for those beans, and elevators are bidding up. Already, I've seen some improvement in basis just with groundbreaking. So this is very important to the farmer's bottom line, as these guys will attest. As a soybean farmer, I see that the fuel that I burn in my combine is actually the fuel that I harvest with my combine as I combine soybeans, knowing that some of that oil will find its way into biodiesel and renewable diesel.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
What do USDA's latest adjustments to its fall harvested crop production forecast look like for November? The Thursday report from the National Agricultural Statistics Service shows a 1% month-over-month adjusted increase in forecasted corn production. If that holds, that would be a new record for domestic corn production. The rise is fueled by an almost 2 bushel per acre increase in yields from October. Soybean production also rose from the previous month. The 1% increase in November comes in part from a slight increase in bean yield from last month's projections. The all-cotton forecast for this month rose 2% at over 13 million bales. Again, higher adjustments in cotton yield contributed to the production forecast, with USDA reporting a 16-pound yield increase from the previous month. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.